My deep appreciation of theater history was instilled in me by Tom Empey, a college mentor to me and hundreds of others. While teaching Greek theater terms, he would grab the fabric of his slacks and say, "You see these pants? Euripides, Eumenides," making light of content that could be considered rather dry and stuffy while still maintaining respect for the art, which is what I want to do with this podcast. For each episode, I invite a guest from the many paths my theater career has taken me down. I give my guest no idea what we'll be talking about, but they know we're going to find an outrageous story about theater history and perhaps get a better understanding about why we're still doing it after all these years. So welcome to Euripides Eumenides, and I am your host, Aaron Odom. Apocalypse, I said, why you want to show up now? Just when the heart of my life was getting good. I'll give you one more chance. Walk on out of the door, yeah. Get your ass to getting where the getting is good. Hello, my friends and listeners. This is Aaron Odom from Trident Theater in Sheridan, Wyoming, coming to you again for one more episode of Euripides Eumenides, a theater history podcast. This is quite a momentous one. I didn't think I would get this far. No, I did. I did. But ladies and germs, this is episode 20, big 2-0. We've hit a landmark, a deadline. A benchmark. I don't know. It's something. It's amazing. I'm really proud of this. And I don't see any reason why I'd stop. So we're going to have some fun today. I connected with an old friend of mine who we haven't spoken for a long time, but as soon as we picked up the phone and started chatting, 20 years just vanished and we were back in the saddle again. My guest today is quite a personality and has done quite a few amazing things with his career. So coming to me from LA and coming to you from LA is my good friend, Brand Birtwistle. Hello, Brand.
Hey-o.
There he is. Brand?
Los Angeles.
Whoa, that was, man, you got a voice for radio, brother. Okay.
Hey, let's go.
All right, so I'm going to hit kind of the highlights of your career as was kind of explained to me. We both were in LA. You got into modeling. Modeling got you all over the world. You ended up getting into some producing from modeling. You ended up producing LA Fashion Week for a number of years. Kind of went, the fashion thing is not for me, but I still like this production thing. Went into film and video production. And now you've got tons of things on your resume that are just amazing, including a pretty huge music video within the last couple of years. Is that right?
Yeah, I worked with a great young artist named Khalid,
who's blown up
over the last couple of years. I was really fortunate to work with him like twice, right back to back. We did a music video for him right as he was really kind of popping with him and Normani. That raked up the views on YouTube. It was kind of fun to watch. I did a Uber commercial with him for the Grammy.
Oh, yeah.
Nominated for best new artist. I was working with Uber a lot at the time. But yeah, that was a great little summary.
There we go. Awesome.
Yeah. Love it.
We just connected. You just got back from a couple cool trips. You did a cool project in Dubai. What was that all about?
Yeah, that was really cool. I was working with a company called DP World, Dubai Port World. So they do a lot of the shipping logistics. They're kind of like if you think of like an airport, right? They handled all the boating. They handle something like 17 and a half million shipping containers day. the port we went on to was half the size of San Francisco in Dubai.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Security checkpoint. And then from there to where we would be filming was like a 22, 25 minute drive.
Ooh.
You know, ooh. it was a super awesome job. We shot 3 days in here and then we traveled to Dubai. We shot 3 days in Dubai. Yeah, you can. That's just was released. They're rebranding their company. Mm-hmm. So we helped with the rebrand.
I think I saw that video. You posted it somewhere on social media. It was like a three or 4 minute video, right? And And then you just got back from Mississippi, where you were doing something with more music. Is that right?
Man, I just I feel like I haven't stopped bopping around recently. It was like for a year and a half, I was confined in this right where you see me right now, like this. For a year and a half, I was in this fucking apartment, like, and then I broke out and I was like, yeah, let's go. After Dubai, had a huge, huge job through my company that was shooting here in New York. While I had the job going on in New York, I was also in Mississippi, like you said. I went to Mississippi and Arkansas, did this kind of little docu, I don't know, it's to help promote tourism in the South, and we kind of did this blues and food tour.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It's not out. So, I mean, I'm sure it doesn't matter if I talk about it, but, you know.
Wait, there's blues and food in the South?
And COVID. There's also COVID.
Oh, man. Yeah. A lot of it. Sorry about
that. But go, moving on. What?
Yeah. Yeah. What? So, this is from... This is the Brand Productions. Is that right? That's the name of the company. So anybody wants to look them up, the Brand Productions, that's what you're looking at. So
www.thebrand.productions. That's it. No.com. It's just
the brand.productions. Love it. Yeah. Love it. That's awesome. What a life you've made out for yourself. That's really cool. That's really cool. So
I'm very thankful.
I feel just honored that you had a moment to do this silly little show for my, you know, 50 or so listeners, but I'm hoping you get
51 after this.
51. Woo! Hey! So I'm going to go ahead and get into the episode today, because I think this has a lot of things that you might have had personal experience with, not necessarily with this story directly, but, you know, being a producer, there are certain things you have to consider when taking on a project. And so I usually start these with a question, Brand. When considering a project to produce, how much of your decision is based on the fame of the talent that could be associated with the project?
Oh, I mean, that definitely has something to do with it, for sure. Mm-hmm. And how much I like the talent, right?
Oh,
like,
okay. So they
like,
gotta be,
for example, okay. God, I just feel like this is like just name drop city that we're sitting here. This up for. Like, it's a little skeezy, right? Like,
no, it's your business. It's your business. Come on.
So I was asked to do a location manager job, which I'd never done, starring Peter Stormare.
Oh yeah. And okay.
I fucking love Peter Stormare.
Oh yeah.
I don't know if this is a part where would you explain to your listeners, like, go IMDb this motherfucker, because he's
come on. He's, okay, let's see.
You're so, gonna go, oh, he's the crazy Big Russian Lebowski guy.
Yeah.
In every Lebowski's my favorite, right?
Fargo,
exactly.
Lost World, Jurassic Park.
Among
I could go
two
on
right there. Like, yeah. Lebowski and Fargo, he's an icon.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And Armageddon, and I mean,
oh, hey, I forgot him in Armageddon. I need to watch that garbage again.
Dude, AI, he's the crazy guy that's
right.
The dude's eyeballs.
Oh, wait, like, that's a Minority Report. Yes.
A Minority Report. Yeah,
yes.
Right? Woo! He's the.
I feel like we're on a lightning round of a game show right now. This is awesome.
Oh, go. So, you're both winners. Yay!
So sorry, Peter Storm,
paying us, Aaron.
So Peter Stormare is attached to this project, and you're like, I'm in.
They said, hey, Peter Stormare went, yep, let's go. And dude did not disappoint. Like, first time I met him, I walk up to him, and I'm 6'3". Like, he's tall. He's like, we're, I don't know, same height, right, ish. Mm-hmm. He walks up. Dude's got a Hello Kitty backpack on. And these huge boots, and he's clunking around, and he's like, man, I hate these fucking boots. And I was like, they give me the worst goddamn shoes every time. I was like, it's like, this was already worth all the bullshit that I went through.
I'm only here for locations. Sorry.
I wish I was not doing locations on it. Locations the most thankless job, by the way. Quick shout out to all the location managers out there.
So getting back to it, when considering a project, talent can be a big thing, but it also has to be somebody that you feel you can get along with.
Totally.
Okay.
Totally. For me personally, I think that's a bigger thing than other people.
Okay.
For myself, I believe creating the right energy on set and treating people with respect and positivity will create a better production. When I get to drive those options, which I don't always get to, but when I get to have the heavy input on that, I'm going to lean into bringing the right people versus the talented people.
Right. Okay.
And not that they're not both, but if it's like this and it's this person's the better personality versus this person's got a little bit more talent, I'm going to choose personality generally because I think the right group of personality centric group is going to create a higher caliber product than the talented group that aren't vibing because at their point they might clash.
You know, yeah.
It's ego versus looking out for the greater good ultimately, you know? So like, I think when we're focused on the human around us, that creates itself visually with what we're capturing on the film.
Okay. Perfect. Wonderful. I mean, there are people who will hire a name because it's a name and they know that it's going to be a pain in the neck to work with. But if there is somebody who can do the thing just as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. So let's go ahead and tell a little story then, shall we? The Lunt Fontan Theater in New York City's Theater District has seen plenty of outstanding Broadway productions since it was rebuilt from being a movie theater in 1958. The Sound of Music premiered there. And while in recent years, it's primarily used for limited engagements such as concerts or stand-up comedy, it is still appreciated as one of the most ornate theater buildings on Broadway and still houses plenty of huge productions. The theater is named after actors Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontan, a husband and wife acting team who met with success individually, but met with even greater success when they would appear together on stage. In fact, they appeared in the first play to be performed in the newly built and renamed Lunt Fontan Theater. It was Frederick Dürrenmatt's The Visit. The Lunts, as they were known, were great friends of playwright Noel Coward. Noel Coward is known for many plays throughout his career, but one that seems to often end up near the top of the list is Private Lives. Have you ever seen this show or read it? I mean,
I have not.
Blythe Spirit is the one that a lot of people know Noel Coward for, but Private Lives is right up there. Now, the play Private Lives is about two recently divorced socialites who accidentally spend their second honeymoons in the same resort in Deauville, France. In fact, their adjacent honeymoon suites share a terrace. The divorcees, Elliot and Amanda, discover this odd bit of coincidence and under a starlit sky seem to rekindle some of the love they once had. Although they've been divorced for 5 years, Elliot and Amanda realize they want to give their relationship another go, even though they're on their second honeymoons.
Oh, shit.
Uh-huh.
I didn't see this. How did I miss this? This is juicy.
Oh, yeah. So they manage to escape away to Amanda's flat in Paris, and thus ends the first act. The second act begins with Elliot and Amanda oiling the joints of their old relationship. Most of the second act is comprised of battles of wit and hilarious arguments, oftentimes getting quite physical with slaps, and at one point a record is broken over the guy's head. By the end of act two, they find out exactly why they divorced in the first place.
In there.
I don't want to talk about it. Anyway. So I'll sum it up this way, as it's been said many times about this play in reviews and summaries for publication, it is obvious that they can't live without each other, but they can't live with each other. Know anybody like that?
God, why did you pick me for this?
My girlfriend doesn't
have to listen to this podcast.
No. Just kidding. Hopefully she's in another room or state. So I would argue that this sounds like a good piece of light, fluffy theater that might be something of a relic of a particular age, but nonetheless an enjoyable bit of witty, romantic social commentary. Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, Like as said, sounds a little close to home also, dude.
Well, I mean, you know, there's those great old famous jokes like, hey, take my wife, please. You know, yeah. I mean, it's marriage jokes always do well, right?
Yeah, because marriages work, right?
All the time. There's no statistical analysis that says otherwise.
Yeah.
However, in 1983, an ironic production of this play was launched at the L'Enfantin. Ironic because of the casting of the two leads and the namesake of the building. Now, while it's common for a production to hire big name talent to attract ticket sales, this production would be produced by none other than Hollywood legend Elizabeth Taylor, famed film actress, who would also be
slapper of faces, right?
Yep.
Already.
Yep. And she would be playing the lead role of Amanda. Opposite her in the role of Elliot would be another famed stage and film actor, Richard Burton. Oh. And if you're not too familiar with those names, don't worry, you will be by the end of the episode. But to those of you who are familiar, I'm sure your spidey sense is tingling. Now, are you familiar with
Taylor, but not Richard Burton so much.
Not Richard Burton. Yeah, I mean, he did a lot more, like he was more known for his stage work and he did some great movie work too. I'm not going to deny that, but yeah.
Okay.
He came out, I'll get into it here. So let me briefly explain why this casting would draw attention. I'll start with a short version and then get into some more detail. You see, the romantic entanglements of Taylor and Burton, or Liz and Dick, as some journalists would call them, they were basically common knowledge based on the scandals involved in their relationship, as well as their extreme personalities off stage and screen. Mm-hmm. Simply put, from the time they met in 1962 to the time that they were on stage together in Private Lives in 1983, they had broken up two marriages to be with each other and subsequently married and divorced twice. They married and divorced twice.
Oh, no, learn your mistakes the first time, man.
So I think you're seeing why this might be somewhat problematic.
That's amazing. That's amazing. And she produced this herself, very self-aware.
Yeah, yeah.
Way to go. She's like, hey, look at this. Hey, everybody. We're pretty fucked up. Like,
you want to come see how fucked up we can be?
Yeah. Look, we're aware how fucked up this is. It's so fucked up, it's funny.
Wow.
Okay. I hope I can be that self-aware someday. Maybe I am now.
Man. So they really officially met on the filming of the huge Hollywood epic Cleopatra. Okay.
Okay.
Now, before she was cast as Cleopatra, Taylor had recently been the subject of something of a romantic scandal with her current husband, the famous singer and actor Eddie Fisher. Before marrying Fisher, Taylor was very good friends with Fisher and his wife, Debbie Reynolds, who is also an actress. And Star Wars fans may know Debbie Reynolds as the mother of Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia.
Hey.
Right? It's so much interwoven here. In fact, Debbie Reynolds and Elizabeth Taylor both grew up as child film stars and were often in the same classes as they were educated on set in the studio, you know, the studio school stuff.
Yeah.
So anyway, Fisher and Reynolds were married and good friends with Elizabeth Taylor and her boyfriend, Mike Todd, a well-known and well-liked film producer. The two couples were often seen together in public and would often spend time together when not engaged in their film and music careers. Fisher and Reynolds, in fact, they were the best man and matron of honor at the 1957 wedding of Mike Todd and Liz Taylor.
Wow.
Okay, so
she looks good in that wedding dress. I'm looking better next to her.
Now, for those of you who do know a little bit about Liz Taylor and those of you who are counting, this would be Liz Taylor's third marriage. She was 25 at the time of her
thought.
So she's been through three of these at 25.
What?
However, when Mike Todd died in a plane crash just over a year later in March 1958, Taylor was emotionally destroyed. Eddie Fisher immediately flew from wherever he was to console his grieving friend, and he remained a constant presence.
Dun, dun, dun. Banging the friends, banging the friends. Banging all our friends all over the place.
I know that you're really emotionally wrecked right now, but...
but let me slip into that.
Within a month, it was announced that Eddie Fisher would be separating from his wife, Debbie Reynolds, as he had begun an affair with Elizabeth Taylor.
Slut.
Yep. News of the relationship soon spread worldwide, and Taylor was basically labeled as a homewrecker and a man-stealer, even though it was Eddie Fisher who made most of the moves. Eddie Fisher and Elizabeth Taylor married in Las Vegas on May 12th, 1959. This was her fourth marriage. She was 27.
Damn. Round, round, get around. I get around.
Yeah. I mean, isn't there something like, you know, when you look at stats, like of a baseball player, a basketball player, you go, okay, they look good in the paint, but they've got some things against them. When you have multiple marriages and you're like number four or five, don't you just go, you know, maybe no.
I grew up in Denver in the Elway era. Elway was a fourth quarter quarterback.
Right, right.
Like they could be so far down, but that motherfucker is going to pace himself and pace himself and pace himself. And when he has to show up at the end and pop, 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 push him the extra yard.
Yep.
We won again and again and again forever. The Broncos were not to be trifled with for fucking decade. Like they were badass, always showed up because they could go the distance. You know, Elizabeth Taylor, she got that like first quarter looking real good. Second quarter, you're like, what the fuck is this bitch doing? This isn't good. Third quarter, you're like, oh no. And fourth quarter, none. She's a first quarter quarterback.
First quarter. Like,
she's a first quarter. Damn, she looks good. Oh fuck, what did I do?
Now, her casting in the film Cleopatra was not entirely surprising then, as she was labeled, most beautiful woman in the world.
And when we're done, before we're finished, I have an awesome piece of art that I have yet to frame that I got of her as Cleopatra.
No kidding.
it's in the other room. It's by this awesome South American artist named Fab Cirolo. And he takes these of iconic figures and he like punks them all out. So she's got tattoos. She's like pulling down her top and she's got the like a black, like the black duct tape over her nipple and she's tatted up, but it's her as Cleopatra. Fuck, it's so cool.
Oh my God.
I'll pull that shit out before the end.
I cannot
see it because you're gonna be like, "Oh shit!"
I swear to God, my listeners, I did not tell Brand that we were talking about Liz Taylor today. So casting her in Cleopatra, like, not entirely surprising. She's an Oscar-winning actor. She's absolutely gorgeous. But she's also got like this label as a homewrecker and all that. Not only that, she had come to be known as wildly temperamental on set and began making demands in her contracts that range from simply annoying to utterly outrageous. I think for this movie, they asked her to do it. And she said, yeah, for $1 million, nobody was getting paid $1 million for a single film at that time.
But she did.
Right? Oh, yeah.
She Boom. Got it.
Yeah, she did. Mm-hmm. She also had a penchant for frequent illness. Which inevitably would slow down production as it would take her a long time to recover. Frankly, the producer had been warned that she would be trouble from the very beginning, but he wanted her face on the poster.
Yep.
So by the time filming began in 1962, Eddie Fisher had taken plenty of public relations damage due to the affair and marriage. So he was basically looking for work. He was given a modest sum to have some producing credits on the film, but made very little effort to actually be part of the production team. What he was really there for was to, air quotes, mind Taylor.
Hey, man, that can be a job.
That can...
Legit, there can be a reason to pay somebody to do that. You know what I mean? Like, in that case, if Taylor is you know, it takes a formula, right? Everything's is formulaic. It's all math. It's all science. It's all as much as possible. How can we guarantee there's butts in the seat, or how can we guarantee?
Now, so, Eddie Fisher, like I said, he's hired as kind of a Liz Taylor wrangler, but not that he could really pay attention. See, his very busy former life made him turn to drugs to stay active and focused. And he was hooked on methamphetamines. So,
great.
Yeah, awesome.
That's always fun to have on set.
For the handler of the lit powder keg. On the third day of filming, Taylor called out sick and remained that way for the next 3 weeks. The entire show was put on hold while Taylor mended her illness, her lingering grief over her former husband's death, and the fact that she jumped right into a limping production that just wanted her star power and that she wasn't the it girl anymore. How did she cope? Tons of painkillers, sedatives, and alcohol.
Hey.
What seemed to do the trick. But this wasn't just faking it. She actually was, quote, variously diagnosed with a virus, an abscess tooth, and a bacterial infection known as Malta fever.
Okay.
Had all that and attacked it with tons of fucking drugs.
Like you do.
Yeah. Now, As I started to get into this and read about the production of Cleopatra, which resulted in the Taylor Burton affair. Oh my God. I won't go too deeply into the details on the rest of that whole debacle because there's literally enough material there for another episode. So I'll hit the highlights that relate to this story. The first director resigned the project after only shooting about 10 minutes of footage over the course of 4 months, costing the studio around $7 million, which is just a little over $55 million today.
Just said hurt my soul. Oh, 10 minutes of footage over 4 months.
And they were filming this great Roman epic starting in London at a studio and some location shots starting in the fall when the weather in London is great. Now, Richard Burton was brought on in the second cast and took up an apartment with his wife, Sybil, even though everyone knew he was a voracious womanizer and quite a drinker. But he was generally liked on set because he was known as, quote, a charmer, adored by his peers for his erudition, basso speaking voice, Welsh barroom raconteurship, and sexual magnetism.
God, I wish my crew spoke like that.
So Burton's on set now. Burton and Taylor hardly let any time go by before beginning their scandalous affair. And while some initially claimed the affair would be just a rumor, here's a quote from a Vanity Fair article on the whole Cleopatra mess. At one point, Burton had stridden triumphantly into the men's makeup trailer and announced to those present, "Gentlemen, I've just fucked Elizabeth Taylor in the back of my Cadillac."
He's like, high fives, high fives. Dude, you canceled. Can't do that.
The affair caused incredible bad press, but became international news that became a bigger headline than John Glenn's first orbit around the planet. Paparazzi were everywhere and did all they could to get more stuff to print. Here's a quote. Martin Landau remembers a night shoot on the island of Ischia involving Taylor and Burton, where the crew's spotlights, once turned on, revealed paparazzi bunched up like moths. He said, "Behind us was this cliff with shrubbery and growth coming out of it, and there were 20 photographers hanging off these things with long lenses. A couple of them fell 30 feet. Burton's older brother, Ifor, came to set and beat him up.
That's not a real name.
His wife.
That's not a real name. Ifor. It is.
They're Welsh. Ifor. I-F-O-R.
Burt Whistle. My last name's Welsh. Ifor Burt Whistle. Oh, well, yeah, I guess that sounds fucking about right. It's all goddamn ugly and long. Sorry.
So, yeah. Anyway, Burton's older brother, Ifor, beat him up, and this stopped production until Burton's face could heal from the bruising and the cuts.
Wow.
Burton even tried to stop the affair a couple times at the suggestion of studio executives. The first time he left the set for another acting gig after he said, "It's over, Liz," and Taylor was rushed to the hospital for that night for what was called food poisoning. What really happened was she overdosed on sleeping pills.
Oh, shit.
Oh, and Taylor was more or less shamed by the Catholic Church when the Vatican City published its condemnation of the affair in their weekly newspaper, calling the romance erotic vagrancy.
Hey! Gotta leave it to the Catholic Church. Keep it classy.
Right. But Le Scandale, which is what Burton and Taylor called the affair afterwards, waged on. On one occasion, the pair left for an Easter weekend getaway without telling anyone, which of course shut the production down. They went to the small coastal village of Porto Santo Stefano, where Burton had to run his car off a road into a ditch to avoid a swarm of paparazzi who had descended upon them.
Jeez.
Now, here's a big long quote, and I freaking love this. In the meantime, Taylor returned abruptly and solo from Porto Santo Stefano and was rushed for the second time in 4 months to the hospital. The following day's papers carried news of a violent quarrel that had prompted Taylor to walk out on Burton as he stood smoldering on the porch of the stucco bungalow which they were staying in. Burton told her to go get rid of herself, which she tried to.
Ooh.
This is the one time that she really took an overdose and was really in danger. Now,
what year was this?
This is like 62 still.
Okay.
Taylor again done.
And she's popping sleeping pills and mixing it with alcohol.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's...
Oh, and painkillers too. Now, again, Taylor denies that suicide was her intent, saying that she needed some respite.
Yeah.
I just need a break. I'm going to put myself into a coma, if that's okay.
Yeah. Don't worry about it.
Now, when Taylor returned to the set from this unexpectedly violent tryst, she had two black eyes, and it took 22 days for her to recover before filming could resume. Now, Taylor attributed the injuries to smashing her face on the ashtray while laying down in the back seat when Burton had to run off the road.
Jeez.
Mm-hmm. The film was released in 1963. Neither Taylor nor Burton attended the premiere.
That just sounds like a nightmare. A
little bit.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. Now, their respective marriages ended within months of each other. Burton's wife, Sybil, divorced him in December 1963. Eddie Fisher made a very turbulent exit and basically finalized everything with Taylor over several nasty phone calls. But their divorce was finalized on March 6, 1963. Oh, wait. Burton's wife, Sybil, divorced him in December 1962. Sorry about that. That seems weird. And Eddie Fisher and Liz Taylor were divorced on March 6, 1963. Burton and Taylor married 9 days later on March 15th, 1963.
On to the next one.
They did their best to blend their families at first. Burton had two daughters and Taylor had three children from two of her marriages. Their relationship was still as much tabloid fodder as it had ever been, but it wasn't like they had settled down at all. They loved partying, drinking, and doing both of those things to an excess. They owned homes all over the world and traveled quite often. They always stayed in the best rooms, in the best hotels, and would always pay for the suites on the floor above and below their own suite. Their immense personalities would cause them to frequently get into terrific screaming matches, and they didn't want to disturb the other guests.
Wow.
Now, they could afford this lifestyle of partying, jet setting, and marital strife because after Cleopatra and the scandal surrounding their romance, they were box office gold.
Yeah.
Now, before that film, Burton was more regarded for his stage work, and when he's in his element, he's a terrific actor. He gives terrific performances. But after Cleopatra, he joined his wife in movie stardom. Like, he'd done a few movies before that, but
yeah,
this is where it was like, okay.
Stepped him up to that,
Burton did continue working on stage soon after, though, very famously for his turn as Hamlet on Broadway in 1964. Taylor continued making movies now that she was solidified as one of the great on-screen talents. And not that she wasn't before. You know, people had grown up seeing Liz Taylor on screen. Now she's this adult. Now she just made Cleopatra. Now she's in this horrifically scandalous marriage, which is her fourth, his second. After Cleopatra, they were featured in 11 more movies together thereafter, only one of which is really worth mentioning, 1966's Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? That was bloody amazing. It's based on the Edward Albee play. In another ironic twist, The play is a scathing critique of marriage in that Burton and Taylor's characters treat marriage as a battleground, fueled by sexual taunts, violent verbal and physical abuse, drinking, and brief reconciliation. If a winner emerged from any battle, the victory was short-lived.
They fought well.
Yeah. Oh, here's this play. We're going to turn it into a movie. What two husband and wife actors can...
Oh. Hey, that's awesome. We fuck. All right, let's go.
Now, when offered the parts, Taylor initially declined, stating that she knew she wasn't right for it. Burton prompted her to take the part by saying, whoever plays this part will get an Oscar. If you don't, someone else will.
My cat is vomiting in the background.
as you're talking, I hear, bah, 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 bah. And I'm just like, Aaron, you got to stop this shit. I know audio too well. If anybody's listening to your podcast, and they go, bah, bah,
bah. Well, I don't have my headphones on. I might not be able to hear.
I mean, if I were you, I'd put this in. This is the gem. This is like...
Do you need to take
you give me out? 2 minutes. Okay. Pause recording.
So in something of a bit of commentary, we had to take a little pause there. Brand's cat was... your cat can't hear this, but I want to think that there was some cosmic thing that's just like, I'm sick of Dick and Liz. And you needed to yap. Yeah. Crazy. Right. So anyway, when offered the parts for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Taylor didn't want to do it. Richard Burton says, if you don't do it, somebody else is going to get an Oscar for it. Both were nominated for their performances, and Taylor did win her second Oscar for the film.
Damn.
However, many would ponder that even though their performances were extraordinary, that they were not far from real life for Burton and Taylor.
Can you hate on that though? Like, you know, I gotta say, I think a part of being a good actor is knowing the roles that are right for you and playing into that, right?
But there is an element to that. Like, do you understand that you know you can do an amazing performance? How close is this to real life? Like, honestly, I've had to debate with myself over Kevin Spacey in American Beauty. Amazing performance, wonderful, okay. Beautiful performance. And then you find out he's a sexual predator. Sure, it's of men, but his character in American Beauty is a sexual predator. He basically groomed a 13-year-old
that's
girl.
So crazy.
So you're like,
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So getting back on it here.
All right.
So yeah, people are kind of wondering, you're picking parts that seem like you're just playing yourselves on stage. You're having these horrible, tremendous fights wherever you go, but you're having a great time.
Okay.
Now, perhaps to keep things in balance, Burton also had a fondness for buying incredibly exquisite gifts for Taylor, stating, I love Elizabeth to the point of idolatry. Two of these gifts were some of the most expensive diamonds in existence. One was the pear-shaped 69-carat diamond known as the Taylor Burton diamond, currently valued at $18.8 million. Another was the 33-carat Krupp diamond, currently valued at $9.25 million.
Money means nothing.
Yeah.
At that point, right?
Ah, I can just get it.
Here's $27 million on diamonds.
That's it.
I got that. I saw my fingers. Like, what the fuck, man?
Now, all this professional success and doting on each other didn't stop the drinking and fighting. By 1973, their romance could not overpower their rancor towards each other. They appeared in a TV movie called Divorce His, Divorce Hers, and as seemed to be happening several times in their relationship and respective careers, life was imitating art.
Yeah, they're leaning into it at this point. Mm-hmm. They're like three or four projects in going like, hey, we're the fucked up couple. And
yep. Battling Burtons, as they came to be known, divorced in 1974. Mm. The divorce seemed to take quite a toll on them. Taylor was still subject to her frequent medical maladies and was basically uninsurable as an actor because of this, despite being such a box office draw. Burton, despite already having quite a reputation as being a boozer, ascended to new heights. He even quoted that during that time, he would be drinking 3 or 4 bottles of hard liquor each day. This may have also been because his brother Eifer injured his back at Burton's home in Switzerland.
Fake name. Hashtag fake name.
His brother injured his back in Switzerland at Burton's home and became paralyzed. While he didn't exactly say it, Burton adored his brother, and the accident seemed to plunge him even deeper into depression. Oh!
Yeah!
Reconciliation is at hand! Burton and Taylor stayed in fairly constant contact after divorcing in 1974 and remarried in 1975.
He definitely had a big dick.
Of course.
You've never had a podcast like this one before, but I'm telling you, he had that big dick energy, obviously.
So Burton and Taylor remarried 1975. Of course, this was after Burton was briefly engaged to the Princess of Yugoslavia for a moment and then broke off the engagement. But, you know, what are you going to do? After Burton was engaged to the Princess of Yugoslavia and Liz and Burton remarried, they quickly realized just why they divorced in the first place and quickly divorced again less than a year later. Here's a quote from Burton. Elizabeth and I lived on the edge of an exciting volcano. I'm not easy to be married to or live with. I exploded violently about twice a year with Elizabeth, and she would also explode. It was marvelous, but it could be murder.
You know what that is? Those are people living with passion.
Yeah.
But lacking compassion for each other.
Yep. Neither of them really recovered the glory of their careers. They had made their way for a while, but the public just seemed to be cooling to their lives of excess, despite being able to turn out great performances every now and then. They did stay in contact after their second divorce, and similar to their characters they played in 1983's Private Lives, they knew they couldn't live with each other, and they couldn't live without each other. So, oh yeah, I just mentioned Private Lives. Well, how about we get back to that?
Hey!
Now, Taylor met longtime Broadway producer Zev Buffman on opening night of his revival of Brigadoon on October 16th, 1980. At the after party.
Can we stop again? Because that's another fake name. Zev Buffman. Eifer and Zev Buffman here.
Uh-huh.
I want to read a comic book about Eifer versus Zev Buffman. I'm going to change my last name, Brand Buffman. I'm working on turning your podcast into a morning show as people are going to work. You and I, we're just going to do this morning. Hey, welcome to KS107.5. Welcome you to the classics.
And we got to have some really stupid names. Like one of us has a normal name and the other is like a noun. Just, you know, it's like, and it's Brand and the Scuzz or something like that.
Yeah. What's up, the Scuzz?
Yeah. How you doing? And that co-host has the worst voice you've ever heard. And, you know,
I think I've got to be great.
All right, that's okay. I'm going to go back. We'll talk about Private Lives some more. So, yeah, we just, Liz Taylor, Zeb Buffman, the producer, meet on opening night of his revival of Brigadoon on October 16th, 1980. At the after party, they strike up conversation and thought they'd do well to get into the Broadway business together. Taylor seemed to be tiring of the recurring role on General Hospital that she currently had. So, this would help her get back more into more in-depth acting.
Okay.
Their first collaboration was a revival of Lillian Hellman's The Little Foxes, which opened to phenomenal reviews, an 18-month international run, and all parties made bank on the production. Taylor, it would seem, had a taste for Broadway. So, when she approached Buffman again about further projects, they brainstormed and came up with a load of different shows, but very heavy material. But then when they started thinking about comedies, Taylor immediately thought of Private Lives. Taylor and Burton knew Noel Coward personally when they were married, and she was quoted in an interview, "Noel used to tell us all the time that we totally fit in her play." Noel Coward is a man, never really officially came out that he was gay, but everybody freaking knew it. So Liz just called him her as a sign of affection. By this time, Burton had gone sober after a stint in rehab and taking medication to make alcohol consumption really uncomfortable. He had married and divorced his third spouse by 1983, and had Taylor had recently ended her sixth marriage. Therefore, both of them were unmarried, although Burton was seeing Sally Hay, who would be his fourth wife in his fifth and final marriage. And both of them knew just the fact that this would be their first appearance on stage together. Well, just take my money.
Make it rain.
Thus, the media circus began again. The very predictable army of both paparazzi and paparazzi deflectors surrounded the Schubert Theater in Boston, where the play had its out-of-town tryouts. An incredibly negative review by critic Kevin Kelly appeared in the Boston Globe after the first preview night, headlined, "Clumping Through."
Oh, ouch.
Kelly appeared on local TV to give his review, and the anchor responded at the end, "Well, thanks a lot, Kevin. I'm going to save my $37.50 and not see Private Lives." Well, of course, Taylor's crew defended the negative criticism by relaying to the press that the opening night audience demanded 5 curtain calls for Burton and Taylor. Plus, the entire run for the Boston preview was already sold out.
Okay.
Nonetheless, the next day after the opening night, the entire creative team was back in the Schubert, tirelessly rehearsing and over-rehearsing, which is always a sign that a production isn't doing well. Taylor defended this pretty zealously, as she was pretty hurt by the negative review by Kelly. Here's her quote. "We're still feeling our way. We're rehearsing here, for heaven's sake. That's what out of town is for. Of course, we have a lot of work to do. This is my first production. Zev and I are going to be doing a lot of things together, plays, films, and someday I intend to direct. And believe me, I've had the tact not to point out to Richard that he's now my employee."
Ooh, damn.
You have the people of the city of Boston going, "Well, thanks for bringing us an unfinished project." I mean, frankly, the production had quite a few problems. The director had over-directed the show to the point where cast members besides Burton and Taylor had already threatened to quit. The director was being replaced the week after opening. And in addition, both Burton and Taylor had some physical ailments that were preventing them from looking comfortable on stage. Taylor had been in a serious car accident in Israel that previous winter, and her legs still had significant bruising months later. Burton had consistent back pain, so any kind of physical requirements of the show were slow and laborious, and rehearsals had to pause anytime he needed to take a break to rest.
Mm.
But mainly, the two stars seemed to almost have an ironic misunderstanding of the script. From an outside view, it seemed that neither Burton nor Taylor could see how the story paralleled their lives too closely, and how much of the dialogue would almost be a little too close to home to be humorous to the audience. I guess there was one night they were rehearsing, they had a dance sequence, and they flopped down on a bed, and Burton looks over and goes, "Hey, you're still wearing my wedding ring." "Yes, I can't take it off." These were not lines in the script.
But it made it in, right?
Yeah, sure. In an interview during his first run in Boston, Burton mused on why he chose to do the project. "I think there's some fun in it for me, especially when I start inventing my own lines. It gives me a great deal of amusement, although Noel must be spinning in his grave." Even more ironically, in their respective dressing rooms, both Burton and Taylor had photos of themselves with Noel Coward from decades earlier. They claimed it was for inspiration. The Boston preview ended financially well, but because of some negative reviews, the Broadway run was approached with some skepticism. Despite starring Richard Burton, who won several stage awards for acting and been nominated for 7 Oscars, and Elizabeth Taylor, who herself had won 2 Oscars for Best Actress and a play that has been described as actor-proof in If the Dialogue and the Rhythm... Yeah, here. If the dialogue and rhythm of the play are respected and directed well, it will be a hit every time. So you don't need somebody who's a great actor. They just need to understand how to deliver comic lines. And they get 2 people who have never done comedy.
Wow.
Here are some excerpts of the New York Times review of opening night. "When Mr. Burton makes his first entrance, his face is a taut mask, frozen in an expression of less than exquisite pain, and there's no bounce as he walks about on his stacked boots. He's not Noel Coward's He's not Noel Coward's flippant hero, Elliot Chase. He doesn't even seem to be an actor. Mr. Burton mostly resembles a retired millionaire stealing himself for an obligatory annual visit to the accountant. He's bored out of his mind.
That's brutal.
Here's the section about Liz Taylor. Miss Taylor, soon to follow, is scarcely more buoyant. Miss Taylor isn't trying to play Amanda Prin. When she looks at her co-star, she looks past him, not It's only when she stares out in the vast reaches of the Lunt Fontaine that her eyes reveal a hint of sparkle. What she sees then is a full house. And the review continues. And so you have the complete picture. While this Private Lives does plod on and on and on for another 2.5 hours, despite substantial pruning of the script, the first impression it leaves is the last. From the start, the production never pretends to be anything other than a calculated business venture. Though the irresistible plot mechanics keep Act One sporadically afloat, the two acts to come have all the vitality of a Madame Tussauds exhibit and all the gaiety of a tax audit. Nothing that happens at any time has any bearing on Coward's classic 1930 comedy.
Oof. That's like 1-2 punch. Like, that is just, that's mean. Mm-hmm. But what a great description that was.
Like, I know, I right?
I could just see him clonking around the stage. Money, 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 money. And then I see her.
I go
like,
over here, I see yes, something.
Look at how fabulous I am. Mm-hmm. Money. They're both, they're thinking, ultimately, that's probably why they got along really well, is because.
Oh, yeah.
They had a passion for each other and for themselves and for being rich, bitch.
Yeah. Like, you know? The production ran for 63 performances on Broadway, closing 6 weeks after it opened.
What's the longest theater run you've ever done?
Longest run I've done. I did a Shakespeare in the Park in Seattle for about, honestly, it was 8 weeks.
And how often were you performing?
About 4 or 5 performances a week.
That's a lot.
So that's a lot. Like, that's a lot. But it's, when you talk about a Broadway show, this has to be big money and it has to get people there and they have to keep coming.
Right.
So if in the first couple of weeks, people are going, I'm just watching this man clunking around on stage and not really understanding the humor of the lines he's saying, much less.
That is actor proof. These lines that are actor-proof, right?
Actor-proof, right?
Yeah.
Okay. After a brief national tour, the production finally closed in L.A. to similar reviews. Here's an excerpt from one. A flat but acceptable pass at Coward's Comedy. It's Liz and Dick's crassly spoofing themselves in public. It's part Private Lives and private joke. Mm. Private Lives would be the only time that Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor appeared on stage together. Richard Burton died in his sleep in his Switzerland home about a year later. The cause of death determined to be a brain hemorrhage. He was in the middle of filming the film adaptation of the sci-fi classic novel 1984. His footage was used in the film and it would be his final performance.
Wow.
Elizabeth Taylor produced once more on Broadway with the play The Corn is Green, starring Cicely Tyson. It ran for only 42 performances in late summer 1983. And that is the story of Private Lives 1983. There just comes a point where I have to wonder when people tell you something and you go, that's absurd. I couldn't possibly be that. And then you get a good look in the mirror and you go, oh, I guess I'm that thing.
But it's almost like they went, oh, look, I'm that thing. Let's keep doing that thing. Hey, you see how toxic we are? You want to just keep being toxic and we'll make money off of it?
Like, we could just be toxic forever.
Hey, and we're making money. I mean, yeah. I guess and there's probably still celebrities today, not going to mention names, not going to just, because I don't watch any reality TV because it's not real.
What?
Like, what? Yeah.
It's... Wow. Liz and Dick. Ah, I wonder how much awareness they had of who they were. Because it seems like they knew something, but they didn't understand that they had almost become a joke. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like
at first they were doing it without realizing what it was. And then they just kind of continued on and they just still were oblivious to it.
Right.
Which at a point stops becoming funny. Cause at first you're like, ha ha, they're being tongue in cheek. And then you're like, they don't get it.
Liz comes back to the Cleopatra set with black eyes after having a horrific fight.
Oh.
With the guy she's cheating on her husband with, who's still actually kind of around. And they all go, what happened? Oh, I was in the back seat of the car. I got to take like 3 weeks to not do shit.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, here's something else that's kind of funny about this whole situation. During Cleopatra filming, Liz would not film while she was on her period because hormones made her face a little puffy. And she says, well, if I'm going to be the most beautiful woman in the world, I've got to look the part. I mean, that is some self-awareness. I'll give her that. But Jesus
Christ, the question is, does it work? Right. Ultimately, is she right? Like, is it like, did more people see the movie because she did that or not? Like, did it, what had the ultimate bigger impact? That's the question, right?
And that movie too had so many things happen wrong with it. Like I said, they started in like 61 and it wasn't released till 63 because they had to, the first director quit. He resigned. And then they're like, well, we've already put a ton of money into this. I guess Fox Studios was like, this is the only thing we've got going for us. And we have to make it happen because otherwise it'll almost kill the studio. And so they hired another director, Joseph Mankiewicz, and he had to rewrite the entire thing, relocate it, and hire most of the new cast. So it was like, I think people wanted to go see it because it was such a fucking train wreck. But then there's this incredibly juicy love story in the middle of it.
That makes me think of is like, I work with this really incredible visual effects supervisor. He did all the facial reconstruction on Fast and Furious.
Oh.
So they literally had filmed half of the Fast and Furious.
Oh, yeah.
And
when Paul Walker died, is that what you're talking about?
When Paul Walker got in the car wreck and they went, what do we do from here?
Oh man.
And I remember talking to this guy's name is Harrison Marks, but he was telling me that like when they decided that they're going to make the choice to continue with that because they filmed so much of it, right?
Right.
That what did they do? Well, they brought in his twin, right? To do a bunch of stuff. And then he said they brought in the world's greatest mime.
Yeah.
And he said this mime, Aaron, they would talk to you for like 2 minutes. And then he go, hey, can I do you?
Okay.
And you're like, what? And they go, yeah, can I do you? And they go, okay, boom. Like, and boom, he becomes you.
Oh, whoa.
And so then they would take him as how he just immediately takes on your physicality and your, like this dude just, he's like a Terminator, right? Like, and then they took him and they did his facial reconstruction. But I think there's that certain point where you go, again, like in production, you have to weigh what your resources are.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And your resource might be a talent. Your resource and that talent might have a draw, right? And that and it might be because one, they're a train wreck, or two, they're a dysfunctional couple that don't realize that they're playing that out in real life in front of you.
Yeah.
And that's its own draw, right?
Yep.
That everybody else is kind of in on this inside joke. Or like, you know what else it makes me think of? Is Tommy, what's his name from The Room that they did the disaster?
Or Tommy Wiseau, about. Yeah,
Wiseau, right? Like at the Oscars, when James Franco wins and he gets up and Tommy fucking gets up on stage just completely oblivious to the fact that everybody is just like it's not a mockery. It's like this. It's like he's such this enigmatic, like super intriguing, like everybody wants to know what the fuck the story is
right
behind him, right?
Right. Like he's a private millionaire and nobody knows how, right?
And the movie is the perfect disaster. Like watching The Room, well, the first time I watched The Room just is one of those perfect train wrecks. It's almost that same thing.
I think I am something else and people are buying a ticket because they see me completely differently. And once I realize that they see me in that light, I just lean in on that.
Yeah.
Ugh. Like, what came first? Madonna the singer or Madonna the sex addict?
Yes.
Maybe Liz and Dick were scripting their entire lives and seem to pay off sometimes.
Yeah. It is early reality TV in a way. You know what I mean? Like if you think about how that is crossing, and that's people just love that.
Yep.
You know. Yeah.
Well, there we go, man. The Liz and Dick story of private lives, 1983, ended. And everybody thought this could be something, but really, we're here to see just how toxic they can be. My God. Anyway, Rand, thank you so much for coming on this program. I really appreciate it. I'd love to have you back someday to discuss something crazy and wild. But
hell yeah.
For my listeners, this has been another episode of Euripides Eumenides, a theater history podcast. I should be back in 2 weeks, and I will see you at intermission.